Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain, and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Joining me from Brussels, Minister for Foreign Affairs and Defence, Simon Coveney. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning, Pat.
You're about to sign off on a training mission for Ukraine. What will Ireland's involvement be?
Well, this is something that's been in design for a number of months now, and it's something that Ireland has supported. And effectively what this will be is Ukrainian military personnel in training in the EU, primarily in Poland and in Germany, and then the EU providing improved capacity and capability for the Ukraine Defence Forces to protect themselves against Russian aggression. Ireland will have a relatively small involvement. It'll be in areas of expertise where we can offer skill sets that can be helpful in areas like demining, counter-IED, and in broader military management. But the numbers involved will be relatively small, but it's important, I think, that we are involved in this training mission to show solidarity and support, and also to share specific skill sets that I think the Irish Defence Forces can offer that can be very helpful in the context of some of the challenges that the Ukrainian forces face, particularly around demining. I mean, if you look at some of the areas that were previously under Russian occupation, unfortunately, when Russia leave cities like Kherson and others, they leave an awful lot of munitions behind, sometimes deliberately, to try to inflict as much damage on the way out as they can. Skills like demining are really important in terms of saving lives, not just of military personnel, but of civilians as well.
But there is the question of neutrality and the fact that Ukraine is involved in a war, not of its own making, but still involved in a war. And mining, demining is a military activity. Do you not think that in some small way our neutrality is compromised?
Well, we're not neutral in this war. We haven't been since day one. So, neutrality means that we're non-aligned militarily. In other words, we're not a member of NATO. We don't get dragged in or pulled into conflicts because of signing up to a military pact with other countries. Irish neutrality means that we choose. The Irish Oireachtas chooses, the Irish government chooses when Ireland gets involved in taking sides, whether that's in a conflict or a division between countries or regions. And we have taken a side in this war. This is a case of a military superpower invading their neighbor, looking to change international boundaries by force. And we have to stand up to that, as a country that fundamentally believes in international law and the protections of international law for small countries and for not so small countries. So Ireland has been very clear politically in terms of our criticism of Russia, of their aggression, of their war crimes. And I think that what we're doing in the context of supporting Ukraine's military in an effort to help Ukraine to defend itself against that aggression is absolutely consistent with our military non-alignment internationally. But our proactive neutrality, if you want to call it that, in the context of international conflicts, and it's not the first conflict that we've taken sides on. We're involved in training missions in different parts of the world. where we're helping countries to protect themselves and to provide peace and stability in their region.
The G20 is preparing a document to condemn the war, but still Indonesia insisted on Russia keeping its invitation. Putin not going, he says he's too busy. But at the same time, should Russia be there at all?
Well, look, I mean, in my view, countries should be talking to Russia, of course. I mean, we want to bring an end to this madness. There's certainly over 200,000 people have been killed in this war so far, maybe a lot more than that. Estimates last week from the US that there's probably been 100,000 soldiers on each side killed, plus perhaps up to 40 or 50,000 civilians in this conflict so far. I mean, this is human suffering on an enormous scale. We've seen close to 7 million people internally displaced within Ukraine. Nearly 8 million Ukrainians have come into the EU now, about 63,000 into Ireland. We've seen world grain prices, world fuel prices, fuel shortages flow from this war. So, I mean, this is a war that's having an enormous disruptive impact on the world. It's causing immense human suffering. And powerful world leaders who are meeting in the G20 at the moment need to be talking about how to bring it to an end. But we've also got to ensure that we support Ukraine and a Ukrainian perspective in terms of how this war comes to an end. Because they are, let's not forget, are a country trying to protect their own sovereignty from Russian aggression. But of course, and people talk to me about this all the time, why is Ireland talking so much about helping Ukraine militarily? And we have so far committed nearly 70 million euros in support to the Ukraine military, non-lethal weapons, but everything else. We're focused on helping Ukraine to protect themselves, but we're also obviously looking for opportunities to bring this war to an end. But ultimately, that is the Kremlin's choice. Russia can end this war very quickly by leaving a country that's not theirs and opening a political dialogue which Ukraine is more than happy to be part of once Russia leaves Ukrainian territory.
Now, meanwhile, Minister, it's estimated 62,000 Ukrainians living in Ireland. 46,000 are in hotels or else enjoying the hospitality of Irish citizens, and 17,000 in direct provision situations. The hotel industry has warned, given that 1 in 4 tourism beds are occupied by refugees, that this is going to have knock-on effects on the tourism industry next year. What's to be done?
Well, there's a lot to be done, but I think it's important that we frame this in a context, Pat. This is a war effort from Ireland. To accommodate close to 63,000 people over an 8-month period is something that certainly has never happened in my lifetime. And it's put the Irish system under a lot of strain in terms of accommodation, in terms of education, in terms of healthcare, in terms of social supports. We know that, but this is something that every European country is trying their best to offer solidarity towards Ukraine on. And Ireland should be no different. So yes, nearly 1 in 4 hotels in Ireland now are taken by the state to accommodate Ukrainian families. Is that sustainable in the long term? No, it's not. In the context of the demands and pressures of a very vibrant tourist industry now post COVID, but we're going to have to work through that. And there are no easy answers here. I mean, there will still be, in my view, a lot of Ukrainian families in hotel rooms into the spring of next year. But we are working on alternatives, whether that's former army barracks, turning them into accommodation centres, whether it's former hospitals that may have closed, whether it's former nursing homes, former boarding schools, whether it's persuading more families to invite and accept Ukrainian families into their own homes. Which I think is a very good solution for families that may have space and want to show generosity towards a country and a people currently at war. This is a unique series of circumstances, and we can't expect a response that would be normal if we were responding to 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 people coming to Ireland in need of accommodation. By the end
sure,
of the
but
year,
62,000 will be increasing. It could be 80,000 because the winter is going to be harsh. And although some of Ukraine is now free of Russian occupation, what's been left behind is destruction. And people will not maybe be able to go back as soon as they would like to their own country.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, I've got to know quite a number of Ukrainians since they've come to Ireland. The vast majority of them want to go home to their families. The vast majority have husbands and sons and sometimes daughters fighting in this war, protecting Ukraine. And they want to go home to reunite with their families. But, you know, a lot of Ukraine is now in darkness at nighttime. Their electricity grid has been deliberately targeted by Russia. You know, Russia has been for a number of months now deliberately targeting civilian infrastructure like water systems, like energy generation plants, grid systems and so on. So even in Kyiv, the capital, you know, have blackouts at nighttime. And this is a country that, you know, has very, very cold winters. And so I think it's unlikely that we're going to see a large number of Ukrainians returning home anytime soon. I think those circumstances could change in the spring quite dramatically if we can find a way of bringing this war to an end. But for now, Ireland has got to find a way in extraordinary circumstances to offer solidarity so that in a few years' time, when we reflect on the contribution that Ireland made to conflict on the continent of Europe, which is what this is, that actually we can say that we acted with solidarity and generosity when it was asked of us. And I
in
think
addition
that is important to remember.
In addition to war crimes that have been reported from various places around Ukraine, including Bucha and Mariupol, there is also the generality of a war crime when a country targets the infrastructure that maintains the civilian population, and we're talking about electricity and water supplies. Would you support the bringing of Russia to book on the business of war crimes when this war is finally over?
Yeah, I mean, not only do I support that, but actually we're helping to pay for that already. So, I mean, I've been to Ukraine twice during this conflict. You know, I was the first foreign minister actually to visit Kyiv during this war, and I've been to Odessa as well because Ireland has been involved in encouraging and protecting the what's called the Black Sea Grain Initiative, which is to help allow grain get out of Ukraine to other parts of the world where there's huge food security issues as a result of that blockage. So, I mean, and unfortunately, I've seen some of the aftermath of what I believe to be war crimes, but of course that has to be determined in a court of law. But Ireland has committed €3 million this year to the International Criminal Court to ensure that they are well-resourced in terms of collecting the evidence on the ground in places like Bucha and elsewhere, now increasingly in the city of Kherson, now that it's been liberated. And believe me, that evidence is pretty gruesome. You know, mass graves, burnt bodies, you know, bodies that have clearly been tortured, and lots of civilians, not just soldiers. So this is pretty gruesome, horrible stuff. And Ireland is very strong on accountability in relation to these kind of crimes, which is why we want to make sure that the International Criminal Court is well-resourced to be able to take legal formal cases against Russia and Russian individuals for what's happened. And then beyond that, we need to help design internationally a legal structure that's credible to try Russia on the crime of aggression, because the International Criminal Court isn't able to try the crime of aggression. It's not within its jurisdiction. And so we are looking at designing some form of international tribunal that can potentially in the future hold Russia to account for the crime of aggression, which essentially is invading your neighbor to the extent that Russia has done. Because, you know, ultimately, if we don't try to ensure that Russia is accountable for their crimes over the last 10 months, well, then, of course, we give a signal to other world leaders that it's okay to invade your neighbors and to brutalize their population to try and enforce your will by military force.
Bringing it back home, Minister, we want to talk about Northern Ireland and the possibility of some deal on the protocol. And it would appear with the deferral of the announcement of any election until after Christmas and a possible change of law in Westminster to accommodate that scenario, what is required is a way to allow the DUP to walk back down the hill with dignity. That is the political task.
I mean, I think it's about more than the DUP, I have to say. But of course, the DUP are a big part of this. You know, they're the largest unionist party. They represent, you know, somewhere between 25% and 30% of the electorate in Northern Ireland. But they're not the only consideration. You know, I think the broader unionist community, the business community in Northern Ireland, and of course others as well, all have to be listened to as we try to find a way forward here based on dialogue and compromise. Now, I mean, you know, we were very involved in trying to persuade the British government to pass legislation that could push back a need for an election. And I think the two governments are very much in agreement that what Northern Ireland doesn't need right now is a divisive election that has a polarizing impact on public opinion in the context of the protocol and other issues.
But isn't it all about allowing Geoffrey Donaldson to agree to something that appears to give him a win of some kind for his constituency and also to maintain the protocol which the EU absolutely needs to protect the single market?
Well, it's about trying to get the British government to agree to a practical and flexible compromise that involves compromise on both sides, by the way, not just from the EU. So that we can ensure that what was agreed in the withdrawal agreement, which includes the protocol, can be implemented in a way that unionists can accept, that businesses in Northern Ireland recognise is a sensible and practical compromise that has taken account of their concerns and anxieties. And they are real, by the way. And I think we can do that. I think we can do that before the end of the year. You know, there are encouraging signals now from the British government that they're serious for the first time in many, many months about trying to work this out through dialogue and discussion and negotiation with the EU. I think the EU will respond with generosity when the British government shows real intent to try to resolve these issues through compromise and you know, things like sharing of trade data and so on, so that we can deal with the risk management issues that the EU has to take account of in terms of protecting the integrity of its own single market, which Northern Ireland, of course, is part of by extension, as part of the protocol. So, you know, I think the way this works is that there is an intense effort now because we've created a window, pushed back the need for elections in Northern Ireland for a few months. And we need to use this window now to try to resolve these protocol issues once and for all, that I hope can allow the DUP and others accept that there is a reasonable compromise now agreed, and on that basis, we all have an obligation to get devolved government back up and running again in Northern Ireland, so that as we build up to the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, we see a functioning executive, a functioning assembly, north-south bodies back up and running, and we see Northern Ireland starting to function again politically, which we haven't seen for some time, unfortunately.
Finally, Minister, you know, you're very much at the top table of international negotiations and north-south, east-west negotiations here. Will you miss all of that when your constituency colleague, Micheál Martin, pushes you out of foreign affairs and into agriculture?
Oh, God, that's a leading question if ever I heard one. I have no idea what's going to happen in a few weeks' time, to be honest. I'm in Brussels today. I'm going to be in Washington later on this evening to make sure that our friends in Washington are fully briefed on what's happening on the protocol and Brexit. I'll be back then for a weekend of a Fine Gael Ardèche, which is a big deal for us because we haven't had an Ardèche in person for quite some time. And then, of course, we lead into December, where yes, there'll be changes in government, but look, you know, for me, it's been an extraordinary privilege to be in the Department of Foreign Affairs and the Department of Defence. You know, I love this job. I'd like to stay here. But, you know, if there's change, there's change. And, you know, I've been around long enough to to understand what drives those decisions.
Yeah, it's extraordinary reading the reports. I mean, Fianna Fáil seem to want to keep health and housing, indications no change there. They want foreign affairs for Micheál Martin, and it seems they want justice as well. What'll be left?
Well, you know, Fianna Fáil won't be the only ones who'll want things. But maybe they've been briefing more actively than other parties, I'm not sure. But look, my understanding is that there hasn't been a serious discussion between the two, three party leaders actually, because it involves three parties, on what a new look government will look like when the Taoiseach and Tánaiste swap positions in a few weeks' time. You know, I think to be honest, we've got a lot of work to get on with between now and then, and I don't think we should obsess on that over the next month.
Simon Coveney, Minister for Foreign Affairs and Defence, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you.